at all. Yeah. Right, let me take a second to just ground myself. Just walk through the door. Timing, God's timing, eh? Okay, so good afternoon, everyone. I'm Sinead and I'm an addict. So my story is, you know, I suppose you've all got really chaotic lifestyles, which mine was, but, you know, nature, nurture, are we addicts when we're born? I believe I've always had the addict thinking without before I even put drugs in me. You know, I was just a really unhappy child. Everything was negative in my world. So I went through life really depressed, and my mum took me to psychiatrists, and I was playing up at school. You know, no teacher in my high school actually liked me. I was just so, you know, I just fought against the system. The world was against me, and I had to stand up and be strong, and that's the way I continued. And my first drug or substance was alcohol, because that was so freely available at my parents' house. Both my parents, alcoholics. And we just had people in and out of the house at all times. No boundaries, no love. You know, it was dog eat dog from a child. And, chaotic lifestyle from a child. And I learned to survive, and I learned to fight. You know, fight my way through life. And that's what I was planning on doing. So I left school with no exams. They told me just to get out. Like, you're wasting our time. And that's the truth, you know. And then to me, that was rejection. Like, how, you know, you... I spent 5 years giving you my time in this school, and that was my attitude. All I did do was take off people, and I made people just feel shit about themselves, because I felt shit about myself, so that was my God-given right, you know. That's what I thought. So I got thrown out of school at 15. So now what am I going to do? I know what I'm going to do. I'm just going to drink and use loads of drugs and have a fucking party for the rest of my life. And it was great. It was great for a couple of years. And I got into a relationship and moved in with a guy, because like, my parents had no control over anything I'd done. I'd look at them and I'd say, well, you can't tell me. Look at the fucking state of you. You know, so I'd throw everything back at my parents, not at the time realising how ill, especially my mother was. Years later, coming into this fellowship and working through the steps, how ill my mum was just made me take that big step back, and it was more an amends, it was just pure forgiveness and love for her. Because this disease killed my mother and my brother, who was 10 months older than me, you know, so this disease in my family. And my siblings who don't drink and use alcohol, they had this disease within them from me as well. I spread my disease through my family, you know, I had two children from, you know, like attract lights, my first love. You know, he was in the same boat as me, done the same things, and I thought we were going to have this great life together, me and him just going to drink alcohol and use drugs. And, you know, it was just a bit of cocaine, a bit of party stuff, when I was in my teens. By the time I hit my 20s, I was injecting heroin, smoking crack, neglecting my children. You know, I thought dragging my children around with me to crack houses, to dens, sleeping rough on the streets with me, you know. I'd run away from one crack den, get on the train, go down to Brighton, Bournemouth with my children in tow. Delusion thinking. And that's, I thought, well, my children are safe. They're with their mum, the one person that loves them unconditionally. You know, I didn't love myself, so I couldn't portray that love to my children. And I pretty much brought my children up the way my mother brought me up, even after all that blame I'd put on my parents. So when my children were 3 and 4, you know, I started to go to jails, and I'd been in the mental institutions a couple of times because, you know, my thinking was fucked, totally fucked. So on loads of mental health medications, loads of mental health diagnosis. And I actually stepped into that role and I welcomed it, because I could use that as a weapon against anyone who pulled me about my behaviour. So if they're in court, if I'd done whatever I'd done, I was standing in court again, I'd always have a psychiatrist. Go and get a psychiatrist. They'll tell you how mentally disturbed I am. And it didn't work a lot of the time. I'd done a lot of jail sentences. And it was when I was about in my 40s, it was like, am I going to continue like this? I remember standing in the med's queue for my methadone in jail. And I was having a laugh. And then all of a sudden, it was like clarity. I looked at all these young girls around me and thought, why the fuck am I still doing this? This isn't fun. And honestly, I just thought, do you know what? You're going to have to get on with it because this is all you do. This is what you do, Sinead. I had no concept of recovery ever. I was in and out of the drug services for 30 years, since my teens. And I'd keep a drinks diary, I'd keep a using diary, and they'd tell me how well I was doing if I'm only buying 3 bags of gear and drinking 10 Stellas a day. You've done really well. And I actually used to think I was. And I was really abusive to them as well. But they always rescued me. It's all right, Sinead, we're here for you. And that's what I thought people were there to do. I'd got into that pattern from a teenager, like, you've annoyed me, you need to make it up to me. I deserve this, I deserve that. I was really self-entitled, especially as I ended up on the streets as a street bum. I was still very entitled. So I had 2 children and I was constantly on the run from the old Bill or doctors trying to section me. And it now, looking back, I know nothing to do with my mental health. I know I was an untreated addict and I know it's my fucking behaviours. My behaviours, but I pulled a mental health card every time. And the last time my children lived under the same roof as me was 25, 26 years ago. And I'd walked out of my house because things were too much and the neighbours didn't like me and everyone else's fault again. And I'd gone on the run with my children and I ended up in a grotty, really grotty hotel in Luton. Police turned up at my door and opened my hotel door and there's my 2 children and me in a room with 1 mil needles all over the floor. And that was when they said, Sinead, you're going back to jail, but we are getting the social services involved. And my head, it's like, how fucking dare you? My children are with me, they're all right. I actually couldn't see it for what it was. So I'd done what I always used to do was fan at my sister, who decided she wasn't going to have children, she was going to have a career. But my sister has been a rescuer of me, an enabler, all her life and all my life. So I phoned her up and I said, and I didn't even ask, I said, you better get here because you won't be seeing your nephews again unless you come and pick them up because I'm going back to jail. And she done it. You know, because that's what my sister does. And that's how I held my family ransom. I always used my children against them. And this time in jail, I remember every time in jail, I'd get my head down. I'd always have sweet visits, but I'd get a job to look good on, you know, in front of the screws. And but I remember a screw sitting down saying, Sinead, what are you doing? You're not stupid. You're a really nice person. What the hell are you doing to yourself? You know, he said, you've been in and out of here. You're not going anywhere and you're not getting any younger. So I sat and made a vow, okay, what I'm going to do when I get out of here, I'm going to go and see my sister, I'm going to make it up to her, try and get some sort of relationship going with my children. And I still didn't know the enormity of the damage I'd done to my sister and my children then. I was still very self-centred. But I'm not going to buy any gear, but on the way home, I'm going to buy a little bottle of vodka. And that's what I'd done. And then I got off the train in Luton, because this is my hometown. I got off the train in Luton, and I walked into exactly everything I'd left behind. Nothing had changed. I hadn't changed. And a week later, I remember sitting down St. George's Square in Luton on my own, thinking, how the fuck did this happen again? How the fuck have I ended up here on my own, skin, rattling for a bag of gear? This is shit, mate. But no one, and this is why H&I is so important, because I was in and out of the mental hospitals, and the last time I was there, I heard about CA. I didn't attend any meetings in there because, like, I didn't have to. I weren't sick. You lot were just fucking picking on me, wouldn't you? You know, so, but I heard it, you know, and that continued for years, and I'd done so much more damage to everybody around me. And it came to the point where, like, the party was over a long time ago. The party had left town and it was just me. And I was going around with people I didn't like, you know, people doing the same as me, robbing off each other and beating each other up and making up with each other. It was just horrible. And I still feel my rock bottom was a gift, because although I know I've done so much physical damage to my body, I can still go back and feel that emotional pain here when I think back of when it finally come an end to me. I was sitting behind Luton Crown Courts, and I'd be homeless for years, but I'd shift around it, and I got this new little spot with this guy. And I remember sitting smoking crack one night round a little bonfire we'd built, and I had a fight with some guys there, but that was the norm. That was where I'd got to. That was like from years ago, partying in the middle of it all and having a great time, to sitting behind on a dirty mattress smoking crack with strangers in alleyways, you know. That's where my using took me. And I remember this, my head just sort of seemed to pop. And I said, I can't do this anymore. And it wasn't anything exterior, something in here. Like, oh, God, I didn't want to live like this. And I certainly didn't want to die, because I'm too much of a coward for that. I just didn't know what to do. And I remember after 3 years of my sister and myself not having any contact, going to her works and breaking down and saying, like, something's gone wrong with my head. So the only place that they could find for me, and this is a sad reality of it, was back at the mental hospital. No one pointed me to the rooms. No one pointed me anywhere that could help. So it was back to the mental hospital. And while I was in all this psychotic state, I'd allegedly signed a contract to go to a rehab. Oh, my God. When I sort of come around, they told me, you are going to a rehab. The names I called, the workers there, they'd lied to me, they'd made me do this, they're bullying me. I was just straight to victim again, because that's all I knew. It was just clear, Sinead, you either go to rehab or you go back where you come from, because we have got nothing else to offer you. I mean, I remember standing crying and dancing in front of the psychiatrist one day and him saying, Sinead, I've diagnosed you with everything I can think you've got, and I've give you every medication that I can legally give you, and you're a fucking lost cause. And I remember crying and saying, I know. And that was my truth. I thought, this is me. So in my head, I was going to live in this mental hospital, because it had an ensuite shower in my room. I was living it large in this mental hospital, like, and I was sending the other patients out to get me vodka, to get me weed. I was having my benzo dealer up, I was having my gear dealer up on my fag breaks. Life was fucking rosy. And then they said, no, you're moving on to the rehab. So, oh my God, I didn't want to go. This is how self-centred I am. After all that, I phoned up my sister and I said, I'm going to kill myself if they make me go here. And she said, do you know what, you're going. And that was the first time I'd heard my sister stand up to me and tell me how it was. And I was shocked, but really insulted. And so I went round to all the nurses and doctors and said, you're barred from speaking to my fucking sister again. You're making her, you know. Honestly, that was what it was about. And but then this one worker said to me, Sinead, go and see what you can get out of it. Now you're talking my language. Yeah, see what I can get out of it. So I was like, okay, now I'll give this a go. So I reluctantly went there. Oh, my God, I was a fucking nightmare. Fucking nightmare. I walked in, I said, by the way, I won't be doing your groups. Knock my door before you enter my room, blah, blah, blah. Just coming off the fucking street, saluting, do you mind? Yeah, and they just looked at me like, whatever. And I remember one of the counsellors sitting there and said, Sinead, why the fuck are you here? I mean, I'm here to get a fucking flat. And he said, no, all right, I'll rephrase that. Who are you here for? And I said, to get my fucking sister off my back. Do you know, that was how ungrateful and entitled I actually was, because that was my truth. I stayed in that rehab for 6 months, and I fucking needed to. But I was still an ungrateful addict. You know, I was still entitled. You know, I want this, this, and this, and this is what you guys are here for. And when they were telling me, like, your recovery is your own responsibility, I don't know how to fucking do recovery. What are you talking about? The closer it get for me to leave in, and the fear come in. Because I'd had a taste of being clean, but not really recovery. So how do I stay clean, mate? I don't know. And I'd been in this rehab 6 months, and then they're going to let me go. What the fuck do I do? What I know best, I'm going to go and pick up. It's quite simple. I'd made that decision in my head. I can't do life out here. But in the last week of my stay, they let me go to the Campvention, 17. So I went there, and it was like, nah, there's got to be cans of Stella or some racks of coke or a bit of gear floating around somewhere. I'm going on a hunt, and, well, I didn't find any. And I thought, what have these people got to laugh at? You know, I was still in that frame of mind. I couldn't laugh. I couldn't enjoy myself. I couldn't get out of my comfort zone unless I had something in me. So I went back and I tested clean. I come back clean on my drugs test. But I did hear the messages there, you know. Get a sponsor. Sponsor is someone who's armed with the facts who can take you guys through the 12 steps. You know, so now that was my only plan, because the only other life I was going to live was go out and go back and end up back on them street corners and end up in them alleyways. And I didn't want to do that. You know, 6 months of clean time, like, there was a little bit of hope coming in my heart. So I phoned up one lady that I'd heard share, and I thought, oh, she sounds really nice. And she said, well, no, I can't. Sponsor, I've got too many sponsors. Years later, she told me it wasn't, because she said she was scared of me because of my fucking attitude. And I said, that's all right. But she put me in touch with another woman that I'd seen from a distance. I'd never spoke to her. So I phoned her up and I'm like, can you be my sponsor? She said, yeah, sure. And she sent me a list of things to do. You get to your meetings. You get commitments, you reach out to women, you send me a grat list, you pray first thing in the morning, you take time to meditate. Really simple stuff. And do you know what? I come out of the rehab with a new sense of hope. It was just like, you know what, I've got a chance here, I've got a fighting chance. I wasn't that hopeless addict anymore. I had a fucking chance. So I went to this lady that I'd never met before, to her house to start my step work. And I said to her, you know, you don't even know me and you're letting me in your house. Is that what you do? She went, like, I've got God with me. And I'm thinking, fucking good for you, because you're going to need him. Do you know what I mean? Like, wow, this woman, woo. But I went there and I started my step work, and she started sharing her story, and I felt I could trust this woman, and there was nothing that I said in any of my steps that shocked her. She was like, yeah, I get that. First time I wrote my step four, my biggest defect was intolerant. She was like, so, you've been to jail for being intolerant, Sinead. You've been to nut houses for being intolerant, have you? You've been arrested for being intolerant. Like, let's get real. So I wrote it all down, and the beginning of my writing, my inventory, I think, I don't want to write that. It makes me look like a really bad person. But you know what? We're fighting the addict, not the person here. And so you have to get real on that. My step nine, my biggest amends, obviously my whole family. My sister kept giving it back to me, like, no, but I love you. And I'm like, listen to me, I've done so much damage. And my little brother, who I was really resentful for. And then when I went through my step four, I looked at all the actual harms I'd done to him. Like, we lost my parents when he was 13 and I adopted him while I'm hitting up heroin in front of him and my children. And he started smoking heroin and I didn't do anything to help him. You know, I had totally forgot that. He was just a wanker in my head, you know. I totally forgot all the harms I'd done to him. And I talked through my step nine and I come out of my sponsor's house and I felt great. But I don't want to make amends to me brother. But I probably won't see him because I ain't seen him in 10 years. And I popped down to see my sister and my brother was standing there in front of me and it was like, fucking God, really? And do you know the biggest surprise of making an amends to him? He said, I'm not angry about anything you've done to me, Sinead. He said, I'm upset the way you treated yourself. And that was like, oh my God, I never thought anyone cared. It was just all amazing stuff. You know, so for a year, I just immersed myself. Done 10 meetings a week, went to any town, got commitments. I started sponsoring women. A lot of women didn't get it, but that's their stuff. They're either not ready or they're not that connection with God. And there's nothing I can do. All I can do is keep trying. So today I stand here and I've been 3 years, 9 months without a substance. You know, and for someone who didn't know how to do life without using, that is a fucking miracle. And, you know, I never done this on my own. God and beautiful people at CA have done it with me. I'm not alone. And, you know, God is absolutely fucking great, because me going in that rehab and being a right arsehole, I now work in that rehab, and God is putting me in other forms in front of me to work with, you know. God's great, isn't he? And people listen to me, because all I want to do is for them to get well. You know, back in the day, it was like, I'm going to talk you into a false insecurity and take what you fucking got, you know, because it was, I'm surviving, I don't care whether you do. And now it's about helping others. You know, one of the biggest things that makes my heart just swell is after not being there for my children, and both my boys, they're both still in jail. There's nothing I can do for them. I can support them when they need it. I can be there at the end of a phone. I can share a little bit of hope, because my youngest son went, well, Mum, how the fuck did you do it? And I said, I didn't do it alone. And I sit and explain to him. He's nowhere near ready. I look at him and see me 20 years ago and think, you've got a lot of pain, but I can just be there to support him. My oldest son has just become a father, and I'm actually in that grandbaby's life. I get daily videos and photo updates. I'm just so in love with him. He's just fucking adorable. Like, I can rattle off what he's doing, but I won't. Like, he's sitting up. He's doing this. He's eating it. Oh, my God, the love. And just the fact that my son and his partner have welcomed me into that baby's life. It's just like, without CA, without doing everything I've done, and the biggest thing is having faith in God. God will work in his own time, you know, because I was one of them. I wanted instant gratification. I want it done. I want it done now or yesterday. God's plans isn't my plans, and I have to remember that daily, you know, and that really makes life a lot easier. Let God take charge. Like, I was meant to be here at 2, and I got here at 2:05, and I was like, oh my God, I ain't ready to do this. But you know what? God delivers, and that's it. I know I'd be dead. I wouldn't even be on the streets, because like, when I come into recovery, I was 5 stone, beaten. I had bags of clothes that weren't mine that people had donated to the Nut House. That's why I come in, and I had nothing to bring to the table. You know, today I give back. I give back in my personal life. I sponsor women. I listen to them. I connect with them. You know, but before I do that, I have to connect with God, you know, to do God's will. So if you are new in the rooms, do everything I've just stated. Get a sponsor, work through the steps. Find a God of your own understanding, you know, and you will be cared for. Find your worth and know you're worth it, okay? God bless you all.